Next up, Josh Blackman is a law clerk in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. His participation in the seminar is as a young legal academic. His law degree is from George Mason University School of Law. He has published 12 law review articles. He was cited by the Seventh Circuit in Ezell versus Chicago, and he will begin as an assistant professor at South Texas College of Law in August 2012. Mr. Blackman's topic this morning is the Second Amendment's social costs. Thank you very much, Josh.
Alice, thank you so much, and I am very confident that lunch is in 20 minutes. It'll be very brief and concise. So I kind of want to take a step back from what everyone else has been talking about, which is really originalism. You know, what did James Madison think of the right to bear arms? What did John Bingham think of the right to bear arms? And I want to talk from this from a practical and kind of pragmatic perspective. I think in large part, Justice Scalia and Justice Alito and Justice Thomas have more or less repudiated the historical arguments by Breyer and Stevens' dissent to both Heller and McDonald. But I don't think that the court has done a good enough job with the countervailing arguments to the pragmatic arguments raised by Justice Breyer. Both Breyer and Stevens argue that the Second Amendment is unlike all other rights. They say it's different from all other substantive forms of liberty, that's dangerous. And Scalia and Alito really have no response to this. In fact, they almost concede it with their sensitive places dicta that this is something dangerous we need to treat differently. I think that's just wrong as a matter of constitutional law. Just go back to your constitution and flip through. We have a lot of dangerous rights, and I can just go through them. The First Amendment, the right to assemble freely can lead to revolution. The right to write stuff can be very dangerous. You know, in Pentagon Papers case, you can publish stuff that can harm national security. So let's go to the Fourth Amendment. The right to be free in your persons and possessions allow you to evade crime. Miranda. Paul Cassell's written there's actually a correlation between Miranda and actually an increase in crime. There are more deaths because of Miranda. The right against self-incrimination, right against double jeopardy, grand jury indictment. Just keep going down the list. Habeas corpus, you can't just lock someone up because they're dangerous. Due process places limitations in everything government does. I think when you look at the Constitution, we have a lot of dangerous rights. We have a lot of them. And for Breyer and others to simply say that the Second Amendment is unlike other rights because it's dangerous, I think is just wrong. And I think in large part, scholars who write on the Second Amendment need to kind of take this mantle and say, yes, we've kind of already won the originalist battle. But I think at the margins going forward in litigation lower courts, what James Madison thought, what John Bingham thought, won't get the difference between concealed carry or not, or won't get to, can I have a gun, you know, traveling on a railroad, or some of the things like this. It's going to be, what are the social safety implications of it? And I think by comparing it not just to the First Amendment that some courts have done, but really to the entire Bill of Rights, you make a much more robust argument. And this is where I'm going to be a little bit of a George Mason nerd, and there are a bunch of GMU people in the room.
Yes.
We're going to talk about Coates and his famous article, The Problem of Social Costs. And this is really the recognition that all rights have both positive and negative costs, or use the term externalities. That is, take a look at like Miranda, for example. Sure, when someone has not read their rights and left free and they go harm other people, that can have a cost to society. But the reciprocal cost is if we don't give people the right to understand what their rights are and what they don't have to testify, we're actually hurting individuals, we're actually infringing on liberties. So every single limitation, every single law has this double-sorted effect. If you like guns, for example, sure, if a person has a gun, they can go and do something stupid with it, they can harm someone else. On the flip side, when the state asserts a right to keep society safe, and they limit that right, they're actually limiting individual liberty. And I think all too often the discourse on guns is only on the one side. We see Breyer listing all these statistics saying, this is how many people died in this city, and this is how many people died. And these are valid concerns, but we kind of need to quantify, and this gets very difficult, how this limits individual liberty. And John Locke has kind of written more guns, less crime, but that plays into the entire Breyer scheme, whether there's more or less crime. I think we need to do a better job of articulating what is the cost of individual liberty, individual autonomy, dignity of having these rights restricted? Progressives have done a very good job with respect to free speech. We talk about chilling speech and limiting expression in marketplace of ideas. There's been more ink spilled on Miranda than I can imagine that if we have this right against self-incrimination, this allows people to feel free from these police state, from having people bothering them and harassing them. We've talked about the Pentagon Papers case. We don't have this institutional media to tell us what's going on. Even if there's a threat to national security, we're really harming ourselves. So I think just having this discourse has taken one step back. And this is really where the term social cost comes in. This is a term that the court, this is a term the court has used in many contexts in free speech, in Miranda, and otherwise. And they've actually used this term of social cost to balance it, saying what is the cost to society? And I've written one article in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and I have another piece coming out sometime soon, don't know when, specifically looking at the social costs of many of our rights. And it's kind of important to recognize how many of our rights are viewed in terms of social costs, both the cost to society and the cost to individuals. I think we kind of reframe the Second Amendment debate in this context, we'll have a lot more. And just to bring it back to McDonald a bit, Justice Alito's opinion in McDonald does make one oblique reference to dangerous rights. And he says something to the effect of, we've never failed to incorporate a right to the states because it was dangerous. But he doesn't say, we're going to treat the right the same in light of its dangerousness. And that's kind of a very subtle distinction. So I think just going forward, and I have lunches in a few minutes, I'll wrap up and leave a lot of time for questions. We have to just recognize that we have lots of dangerous rights. So the next time some lawyer makes an argument saying, well, you know, X number of people will be harmed by guns, you can say, well, put up a random. You know, how many people are in trouble or on the streets or committing crimes because of Miranda? And I think this is playing an argument that's on what progressives appreciate. They like Miranda, they like free speech. You know, talk about habeas corpus in Guantanamo. In his Boumediene dissent, Scalia had a great line, and like, there will be people who die because of this opinion. He says it very clearly. I don't see much of a difference between that line of reasoning. There are a lot of things that people like. They like the idea of habeas corpus, where people who can be quite dangerous people live out of society. And I think just kind of viewing it through the spectrum makes it more of a holistic argument. And it kind of goes away from the empirical nature, because for every John Locke, there's a Stephen Levin. You know, and then you can argue which is better, which is worse, but there are these competing arguments. So to kind of just put this on a jurisprudential and theoretical level, I think has a lot of normative appeal. And that's really all I want to say, because I know lunch is in about 5 minutes. So any questions or comments or any? Yes, sir.
I was going to say, I've always made a point whenever I've spoken to any public gathering to acknowledge that there is definitely some risk in taking the Second Amendment seriously. And I do point out that relative to other risks, it seems to be pretty tiny. I point out the fact that study after study trying to demonstrate statistical correlations between gun ownership and violent crime rates find that relative to vastly many other factors, gun ownership is so minor that it's often difficult to get it out of the statistical insignificance range. If people were really focused, really concerned about dangerous rights, they would be looking at things that are much higher rates of risk. The institutionalization of the mentally ill, the unwillingness of states like California to hold people for any great length of time for violent crimes until they pass three strikes. There are a great many things that you can point to that are vastly higher risk. If risk is really what's driving this, then guns should be way down on their list.
No, you're absolutely right, and I think it's almost specious when Justice Breyer makes the argument that this is such a dangerous right and it's, quote, unlike all other forms of substantive liberty. I think that's just wrong. And I think that really kind of goes to the core of how many people have this vile reaction, I think that you said before, this innate opposition to the right to bear arms. They view it as this kind of evil. But whether or not you agree in the Constitution, and if you look at McDonald's, Breyer's dissent to McDonald, he assumes that Heller is correct. He assumes, even arguendo, that the right to keep arms is an individual right. And even then, he still views the cost of it as this high. And he fails to acknowledge what the costs are to individual liberty, individual dignity, and the like. Yes, sir.
There's an obvious proximity and a gut check kind of simplicity to Breyer's argument. Because we all understand the proximity of somebody pulling the trigger and somebody being injured versus Fourth Amendment due process kinds of proximity or letting the guy out of jail who then goes and commits another crime. How would you suggest, or have you addressed, how to make the proximity problem less glaring?
No, and that's exactly right. It's very easy to see when someone has a gun and they pull the trigger. That's a very easy cost to quantify, as opposed to something like Miranda, where someone has failed to have the rights, I mean, 3 years after a trial, they're let out of prison. And that's why I kind of take a step back and look at things like the First Amendment. You know, if the Pentagon Papers case, for example, say the New York Times publishes something that harmed national security, it might not happen today, might not happen tomorrow, but maybe, you know, some insidious group can find this in a couple of years and plan something that can hurt the United States, or even talk about, like, First Amendment rights. You can plan a revolution and foment harm to society. It might take years to build the proper movement. So obviously, the proximity makes it very easy to why they don't quantify the social cost. I mean, there's a dead body in the street, there's chalk, you can see that. But a lot of other constitutional rights, habeas corpus, how long that takes, things that go through the system, have this kind of this delay.
Do you consider the social cost of not the fact that if somebody isn't carrying, because the law says he can't carry, and therefore he's killed, okay, there's an obvious social cost to that. Do you consider the social cost of just how we change when we are living in a system where we can't defend ourselves? We can't have the means of defense. And for a woman, an older woman with arthritis and some limited mobility, and the mother of a 27-year-old daughter, there's a real cost in how your life changes because you think, I can't defend myself, so I can't do this, I can't do that. I've talked with Don sometimes about how we complain about how in Muslim countries they say women aren't allowed to go free. They may not go around without a brother or some male relative. In this country, we say, okay, you can, if you're willing to accept the price of not being able to defend yourself. And that, it changes your life. It changes the way you function. Do you consider that?
Yeah, and I really like the way you framed it, because now we're not just talking about the harm to society of guns, but the harm to the individual. And that's what I call in the article, like, kind of the forgotten man. It's from an FDR speech. But in all society, there's the seen cost and the unseen cost. It's like a Bastiat, you know, the seen and the unseen. The unseen cost is you unable to defend yourself or your daughter at night. And I think just framing it in terms of the cost, both the society and the cost to the individual, I think makes the argument that much more profound. And it's not just about statistic A and statistic B, or what James Madison thought and what, you know, George Mason thought. I think it kind of transcends the debate to kind of echo. Richard?
It's a very fascinating comment. Is there an analog between what you just heard in this comment and the overbreath concept in speech, the idea of chilling speech? This might be something like chilling living.
It is.
Yes.
As a woman, it is. Correct. I remember in graduate school, and I was a young woman then, without even any discussion among the women, and so many graduate school classes end at night. There were classes that got out at 9 at night, and without any discussion, we all knew we walk in mass to our cars together, and at the last car, you know, you make sure there's nobody alone. There's no woman who has to get. And women do this. It's so much a part of our lives, we don't even think of it.
Yeah, no, Richard, you're absolutely right. I have an entire page 29 of my article, which I'll send you later. See, when you have your laptop at the podium, you can
just
control F.
That's why I asked the question. I asked the question so you can have the opportunity.
Control F is really good. Yeah, so it's exactly right. And the overbreath doctrine, this is a quote from the Supreme Court, in the case of U.S. v. Williams, it looks to strike a balance with competing social costs. I mean, that's language right from the U.S. reports. One of the reasons I like the use of the word social costs is that the court's been using this phrase for almost 70 years. It's embedded in our jurisprudence. So it's just a matter of giving meat to the bones of what is social cost. Is the social cost to Alice's liberty? And the social cost to the person that she shoots? Trevor.
It also seems to me that one of the worst things to happen to the Second Amendment in recent memory was turning it into a vulgar thing. Because actually enjoying guns and wanting to use them and owning them is not high-minded enough. So in terms of the benefit that you actually get, enjoying the benefit from shoot them, I like to collect them, but that's low brow, that's what we call vulgar. So that, there's also benefits there that are not.
Yeah, and I mean, even frame in terms of, like, you know, Justice Kennedy's favorite word, dignity. I mean, that's the word of the day. I mean, someone's autonomy in terms of self-determination of how they live themselves. Self-defense isn't just this natural born right that Locke and those other guys talk about. I mean, this is what, you know, most international courts are for, to just my dignity, my ability to take care of myself and to determine how I want to live my life so as not to be limited by others. And that's a very egalitarian argument. Yes, sir, in the back.
This is a follow-up on the earlier point about proximity of the harm. One of the other things that's implicit in Justice Breyer, for example, Justice Breyer's dissent in Heller, is the idea that gun control actually works. And if we were starting from first principles, that is deciding whether to have guns or not to have them, we could say, yeah, if we have these guns in the room, then we're going to be more at risk. The point now is that we already have 300 million plus, and for people, even those who don't like guns or don't like the idea of right to arms, open-minded people that if you start with $300 million already in the inventory, saying that you're going to get rid of them is actually different from getting rid of them. So when you end up with these pieces of legislation like you recently had here in Washington, you disadvantage the innocents, and it's, you know, the same story that we all know. But people, as they have this conversation, tend to submerge that fact and raise it in a way of showing the balance between costs and benefits.
You know, that's a good point. I don't even know if it matters, frankly, to Justice Breyer if the gun control is effective. I mean, Randy was here talking before about Williams and Muley Optical, almost kind of this presumption of constitutionality. It probably doesn't even matter if that, even if the government has a good enough reason to. I mean, Adam Winkler just published a great book on the Peller case, and he had this really good discussion of what was on the minds of the D.C. Council when they enacted the gun ban. The people enacted the D.C. government said, we know this will not remove a single gun from the District of Columbia. People from Virginia and Maryland and Rutherford and bring it in. The point was simply, just like Trevor said, to chill guns, to make this vulgar thing, to make them socially unacceptable, to stigmatize them. So I don't even think, to Justice Breyer, if you prove that every gun law is ineffective, that would make a lick of difference for his constitutional jurisprudence. For that?
Yeah. I think it's kind of a natural fit with some of the arguments that you're making to suggest that when it comes time for courts to settle the standard of review question for the right to keep and bear arms, it seems to me that more, significantly more important than which tier of traditional constitutional scrutiny they arrived at, if the rights to be adequately protected, it's critical that there be some kind of burden imposed.
Yes.
And the idea that even if a court thinks you've made an adequate social science case, that such and such a regular restriction is adequately tied to a sufficiently important government interest, that Second Amendment scrutiny shouldn't be like anti-discrimination law scrutiny, where that's all you need. There should also be an analog of the substantial burden component abortion regulation, or perhaps less controversially, you know, in the First Amendment context, it's not enough to have a measure that's adequately related to an important government interest. A time, place, and manner restriction must also leave ample alternative channels for the exercise of the right.
No.
And many state courts use a standard of you can't frustrate the exercise of the right. And if that's so, and we, first of all, you need to get a component like that, I think, to have strong protection of the right to keep and bear arms. And if we do get it, that's a whole new area of empirical research, right? And it seems much more tractable to analyze empirically, for example, whether that California federal district court was right that the right to bear arms for self-defense is not improperly burdened by requiring everybody to carry unloaded guns openly, but you can carry ammunition on your person.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think we're out of time, but just one of the key points to make this article is that going forward, I also think tiers of scrutiny are kind of silly and not have much meat. It's about burdens. Who cares the burden of showing? Is it my burden to say I should have this gun, or should the government say why I can't have this gun? And going back to the question of proximity, I've also cataloged the last Supreme Court cases, and really the level of scrutiny which courts apply is directly tied to how imminent the threat is. If there's a threat that's imminent, think of the Brandenburg case, an unlawful incitement, and about something bad, they're cracking down the whip. But if the threat is more remote, they're going to be more deferential to the government's interests. More deferential to liberty. So depending on how imminent the threat is, unfortunately guns in larger sense are kind of imminent in the scheme of things, but there are a lot of other rights which are quite imminent. Think of the unlawful incitement, think of the public safety exception to Miranda, where courts have kind of balanced these things. We kind of have time, so if you enjoy your lunch, always. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thank you very much.